You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
From the Palmetto Swamps to the Piney Woods, to the Yucatan, you're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast.
You're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast presented by Scree Gear. Each and every week, we are very thankful for Scree's support of the podcast. And I know this time of the year, we are getting very close to deer season. There are some seasons out of state, obviously, that are open up. Myself, I'm about to go elk hunting, and there are some whitetail seasons opening in the Midwest and other places. And people are starting to get geared up, and I want to encourage you to check out Scree. If you're looking for some new camo hunting gear, quality stuff, you can shop it all online at ScreeGear.com, and I tell you almost every week, but it is such a great deal. They bundle a lot of their they do bundles of a lot of their gear, and so basically what that does for you, there's an automatic discount applied to that, so you're getting a better deal than if you just pick and chose piece by piece. But also they're putting these bundles together with how they perceive is kind of the best setup for you and what you might need. And if you do the Whitetail Starter Bundle, you'll get a 14-day risk-free trial where you can try the gear for 14 days, and if you're not totally satisfied, return it, no questions asked, for a full refund. And as with every purchase with Scree Gear, there's a lifetime warranty as well as a customer sizing guarantee, which means they'll send you prepaid shipping labels, and they'll go back and forth with you through the customer service department to make sure you get the right size if you perhaps order something and it doesn't fit quite the way you wanted. But I encourage you to follow them on social media. Check out their YouTube channel for videos and content. Learn more about the gear, and you can shop online at ScreeGear.com. So we are a couple of weeks out from the national holiday of opening day of deer season. And I say that because I know that there are seasons, when we're talking about whitetail deer hunting, there are seasons that are open in the Midwest especially. But I think October 1st can be widely thought of as kind of our national holiday for opening day of deer season. And we're not far. But the one thing I wanted to mention, because let me back up one step. Joining me on the podcast today, so I'm just going on and on without even. Colin is back on the podcast with me today. What's up, Colin?
How you doing, Lot?
And also, Mr. Benny Gregoire from Buzzard Roost Saddles is joining us on the podcast. Benny, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Lot, man. How y'all?
Doing good. So I got a question. I want to get everybody's opinion on it because I don't even know where I stand on it, and I think it could be an interesting array of opinions about this. So, as y'all may or may not know, Mississippi has a velvet buck season that opens up next weekend. As we're recording this, it'll be next weekend, which will be like September the 16th and 17th, I think. It's just like a, if I'm not mistaken, it's like a two-day Velvet Buck season that they just put into the regulations this year. And I mentioned this, but I think it's relevant because I know a lot of the members of the Louisiana bowhunter community also hunt in Mississippi, with it being a neighboring state and whatnot. So I'm curious, Benny, what's your opinion about this new 2-day velvet buck hunt? I mean, what are your thoughts about it?
Man, I think it's impressive that they have the forethought to do that. And, you know, guys go to Kentucky and everything to target velvet deer. And I just think it creates an opportunity for guys that, you know, may not have the time to head and go to Kentucky or something and hunt public land and everything. But they do have a place in Mississippi, and you know, they can go over there and get a shot at a velvet buck. Man, I think it's a great thing. I wish it wasn't limited to private land only. I wish it was open on public land as well. But other than that, I think it's a pretty good deal, man.
Well, I didn't know that it was limited to private land. I'm from Mississippi, and I have family property in Mississippi, and I've spent most of my life hunting in Mississippi. But these days, I mean, I still hunt there a lot, but I just don't. I mean, I have a lifetime hunting license, and most of my hunting in Mississippi comes after I've hunted at home in October and on the road in the Midwest in November, and so I don't really keep up that much. But, Colin, I know you've gone and hunted some of these velvet seasons both by yourself, and you went with me last year in other states. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think it's really cool that they are doing it. Like Benny said, to give some of these guys who may not have the opportunity to go out of state, to target a velvet buck here if they have, you know, something on camera. But one worry that I have is that it's kind of making the season like 6 months out of the year. And I just personally worry that if you're hammering a specific deer or an area from September through February, might not be the best thing.
Yeah.
Personally, just with, I know how, you know, these guys down here, down south, I mean, they go pretty hard. I mean, it's not like a few hunts here or there. A lot of these guys are all weekend, you know, multiple hunts a week. And that is one concern that I have, that I don't know how it would affect, you know, the population in that, on that particular property.
Well, I'll say this, and Benny, you've put a little bit of an asterisk in my thoughts about it, because I didn't realize it was limited to private land. So that maybe changes some of my thought about it. Being a native Mississippian who grew up and learned to hunt and still spends some time every season hunting in the state, it's a little close to home, just anything that Mississippi does, because it is home. Well, it was home up until 2003. And my thought about it is this, and when I compare it against, you know, you made the comment, Benny, that, you know, a lot of guys do the velvet hunts in these other states, and I've taken part in those as well. The one thing that's different to me, however, is those states offer that, and it fits a little bit differently in my mind, because Mississippi already has some of the more liberal seasons in terms of bag limits and days of opportunity. So I question in my mind is, do we need to be, like basically what Colin just said, do we need to be adding pressure and days of opportunity to an already very long and fairly liberal season? Now, with that being said, saying that it's limited to only private land changes my perspective a little bit, because I'm very much on the side of private landowners having a lot more freedom on their land. That's their land, and obviously those aren't their deer, but it is their land, and, you know, this is America, and if they're paying taxes and everything else that goes along with being a private landowner, or whatever, with obtaining private access, then I am sensitive to that, in that I don't think that we should be regulated at a high level, generally speaking, when it comes to just legal legislation. But I do understand that the departments of wildlife and fishery and natural resources and whatever they call it in different states, I know that their burden for legality is a little bit different than general civil legality, in that they're looking out for a natural resource that kind of spans across property lines, so to speak. So I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about it. Like I can say this. I don't want anybody hunting and trying to kill velvet bucks on my private property in Mississippi, because I think that those deer get all the pressure they can handle from our already, you know, established hunting seasons. So that, you know, that is interesting in that regard, and it's always interesting to me when they do things from a regulation standpoint that you can do it on private but you can't do it on public, or vice versa. Yeah, I don't know if there is anything that falls in the vice versa category, but if you're looking,
so that brings up a question. On private land, my assumption would be that y'all are already managing your herd, and I just feel like guys that were hunting private land, you know, I don't know that they would smash the deer like maybe public landers would, and I don't want to give public landers a bad rap. I'm a public lander myself, and I'm not a horn hunter, but it's just always been my impression that the private land guys had their private land under control from a management standpoint, and they controlled the pressure a lot better than a public land spot would.
I agree.
So that's the only question I have there.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. It does seem that regulation has something in it where there's a self-regulation to it. They're allowing this freedom, knowing that where they're allowing it is, in most cases, going to have a self-regulation already in place. So that's a valid point. You know, the last thing that I was going to say about it is, no matter the state, no matter whether we're talking deer or turkeys or waterfowl or whatever, when it comes to hunting regulations and regulating our rights to hunt and all that kind of thing, with the rising cost of goods and record high inflation, wouldn't it be great to save money on your auto insurance? With most companies in Louisiana increasing their rates on auto insurance, American National took a rate decrease. We look out for the best interests of our clients and look forward to earning your trust as well as your business. Call or text Jake Slocum at American National Insurance at 318-255-0096 today for a free assessment. Jake Slocum, American National Insurance, more than just your insurance provider. You're on your way to your stand early in the morning and you have an accident. You run off the road, total your truck. Your bow, guns, and hunting gear damaged, maybe totaled as well. True or false? Your auto coverage covers your bow, guns, and hunting gear that got damaged. False. Your homeowners or rental coverage has content coverage that extends to this event. To find out more, call or text Jake Slocum at American National Insurance at 318-255-0096 today for a free assessment. Jake Slocum, American National Insurance, more than just your insurance provider. Hunting seasons are designed around protecting the natural, using the natural resource, but also protecting it and all that kind of stuff. It's always I don't want to say it's a red flag, but it creates this strange gray area when you're allowed to do something on private land and not on public, because the low hanging fruit there is, well, what about the 2,000 acre deer lease that has 80% of its border is public ground? You're hunting the same deer, you know.
I used the
analogy of recently. We had, you know, the Area 6 WMA Tunica Hills has finally opened up through February the 15th, which is the Area 6 regulations, but they closed the season on the WMA on January 31st. Well, when you look at that, well, we actually had Jonathan Bordelon from the deer manager for the state, and when we asked that question, the answer was, well, our studies show that there's not enough browse, and basically said that we don't need to extend the season on the WMA, but you think that the guys right next door aren't planting food plots and drawing those deer off your WMA and killing them until February 15th anyway? You know, so, the regulation didn't make sense in that regard. So that's my only thing is it feels to me, this is where I get a little bit of a burr in my saddle about any of this kind of stuff. Whenever I get the inclination that something's being done from a legislative standpoint, and it feels like the decision making has more to do with economy than it does wildlife, that is a red flag for me, and I can't help but wonder: are you offering more days of opportunity to satisfy a possible customer base with the economy that hunters bring, or are you doing it for a biological reason? I would love to know the answer. I mean, I know the answer wouldn't be that black and white, but I would love to have that question answered if I could somehow. That would make me at least give me more to go off of and draw my opinion. So, I don't know.
And ideally, you'd like to have both?
Well, it's my opinion, and it's derived from personal experience. So I am a hunter that has been blessed enough to go and hunt in lots of different states. And because of that, I've hunted under a lot of different regulations. And I've seen the effect on the hunting and the deer population in a lot of different places. And I know that one style of hunting doesn't suit everyone. Like you mentioned, you're not a horn hunter. Mm-hmm. Some people, that's what they want. They, you know, they're hunting for trophy and things like that. But I just personally think that we're taxed to the hilt as Americans in general. And so I think that our wildlife departments need to put the large majority, if not all of their decision-making, on the side of the wildlife and not the economy. That's just my opinion. I mean, they're funded through our tax dollars, and a lot of other things. And I'm not saying that they have to completely forget it, but it wouldn't feel right to me if we're allowing more, harvest, more pressure, more everything, for the sake of this will bring more economy to the state. I don't think that should be the job. The job is to protect the natural resource, not to exploit it. And that's a very strong way to put it, and I don't really look at it that strongly, but I don't know any other way to put it. So
I like that. I like that. So if it brought some dollars by providing a velvet season, but say maybe they shorten the season, you know, a little on the back end, or they cut a buck out or something for that, you know, and not just promoting the dollars, but they did something to promote the wildlife.
Yeah.
In the same, that would probably be, I get what you're saying there. I think that's what you're trying to say.
Yeah, there's no way to follow that trail of what's happening with it. And I, like I said, it's not my understanding that the limit has expanded. I mean, it's not like you can kill a deer in velvet now and you still get your regular allotment during the season. I think that deer applies to your yearly right. bag limit. So you're not necessarily killing more deer, and that is a positive in my mind, because I think Mississippi, I'm not one of those that's standing on the mountaintop preaching and prodding. While I do think that they could make some adjustments to the season structure. I don't think they have to, but I don't think they need to expand it either. And there is something to be said for the fact that whether you kill the deer on September the 16th or you wait and you shoot him on October the 1st when he's lost his velvet, you're still killing him. It's still a take from the population in that regard. So maybe that's not the effect. I think the net overall effect of it is, however, how many, and all three of us are obviously bow hunters, so we all know this this story. How many people are able to scout and get on deer during the summer, late summer into September, and come October the 1st, that velvet comes off, those patterns start to change, and that deer that you just knew you had figured out on September the 16th, you don't have him figured out anymore on October the 1st. So how many deer are going to die?
Right.
You know, that natural, the way that they react to the seasons and stuff, have made them a more elusive prey. You know, that would be – I'm interested to see, as we get down the road, what those numbers look like. You know, are we looking at drastic or any notable increase in buck harvest in the state? But that's just something that's relevant. Like I said, because I know that a lot of people that are active in the Louisiana bowhunter community hunt in Mississippi, and it's something that's coming. I mean, as this podcast released, it'll be the day before quote unquote opening day as far as that hunt goes, and so just something interesting that I wanted to kind of get everybody's opinion about.
Hey, it's Brian Chamberlain with Movement Mortgage. We're happy to be back for a second year supporting Louisiana Bowhunter. Just want to let you know that we're here for all of your mortgage needs, whether it's a purchase, a refinance, a renovation loan, or to take equity out of your home. We're also an equal opportunity lender, so whether you shoot a crossbow, a compound bow, a fixed blade, or an expandable, we're here for all of your mortgage needs. You can reach us at 504-228-3780 or at chamberlainteam@movement.com. Movement Mortgage, NMLS number 39179, Brian Chamberlain, NMLS number 114586, licensed in Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, and Florida.
I want to talk about a couple other things, and then we're going to get into Benny, get into to kind of your story and more about Buzzard Roost, the products that you're producing, and just kind of ask you some more questions, more detailed questions about that. But I want to we do get a lot of feedback, and we've been asking for a lot of feedback because we want to have that interaction with people that follow Louisiana Bowhunter and be able to make this this podcast and everything that we do, you know, relevant for everybody. So we've been asking people to kind of give us feedback. What do you want to hear? What do you want to? What kind of topics do you want to hear? Do you have any questions you'd like for us to try to answer? Or at least I don't know that we can always answer them, but we can just give opinions with who's on the podcast in a given week. So I'm gonna read a couple of questions that we've gotten recently and talk about them. And I think this might be one that would be really good for you, Benny, because I know you said you're a public land guy, and obviously you're a mobile hunter guy with the yep. saddles and all that. So the question is, how do you scout land in Louisiana when we don't obviously have the pinch points and funnels like in the Midwest? And I would like to just add to that, and Benny, I'm going to get you to kind of opine on that first, but I'd like to add to that. I think that the answer, part of the answer is that it's not that we don't have them, they just look differently and they're not as identifiable. So maybe part of this answer has to do with how do you figure that out where it's not quite as obvious, but maybe I'm wrong. What's your thoughts about that question?
Yeah, so I think you're right. They're just not as obvious. If you were up hunting in the northern states, the terrain and the hills and everything create your pinch points and your funnel. But like you mentioned, we're in bottom land and everything down here. Excuse me. So I'm not a guy that goes hits boots on the ground before hunting season, But what I do is I'll do a lot of map scouting, and I look for changes in the trees on the map scouting, and I look for transition areas and things like that, you know, streams and creeks and low points. I mean, we do have spots that do show a topography drop and low points, and I like to identify those. And then I'm an in-season scouter. You know, I'll identify 5, 6, maybe 10 of those spots. And then, you know, when I get the time off of work and I can go out there and look, you know, I'll generally take my morning hunt. If my first hunt's a morning hunt, I'll go to a tried and true spot. And then from there, I'll hunt an hour or two, real short sit. If I don't kill anything, I get out and I move on. And I'll go and I'll start in-season scouting. I'll look for, you know, hot feed trees and things like that where the deer are right now. And then I'll develop a game plan after that. But that's generally what I do. I look for the topography changes in the trees and transitions there.
Colin, you got any input on this topic?
Yeah. So I agree with a lot of what Benny said. I think the way I think of it is more of like, I kind of relate our hard transition lines to like a Midwest pinch point. So like if it's hardwoods transitioning to, you know, a pine thicket or a willow thicket or whatever it may be, a swamp. That's kind of what I like try to key in on. And like he said, I like to hunt a lot hunt in the morning and then get down. And then I like to kind of walk around a little bit and see. And one thing I try to do is I try to utilize my cameras, my trail cameras, to try to help me put the pieces of the puzzle together. I'm one that I kind of like to put a lot out, and let them soak all season. And I may not check them all regularly, but at the end of the season, I like to try to see where deer are coming from, where I think, you know, they should be coming from or bedding, things like that. I kind of use the trail camera in that way to help me try to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But really just the transition lines, you know, the property that I've hunted or that I hunt, I've kind of over the years identified those, you know, hot spots, those good areas. I don't think it's something that you're necessarily going to just pick out from the map, from an aerial view. I think you're going to have to get out there and put some time in and either see the deer, you know, use an area or not see them. And then you can kind of check that off the list the same way. So yeah. That's kind of my take on it.
I'll tell a very brief story that kind of culminates in a very obvious statement, but as a young man really learning to hunt, old enough to hunt by myself a little bit, but in a hunting club with older gentlemen that had a lot more experience than me, that I would always try to soak up little bits and pieces of things that they would tell me and try to learn from them. Well, I don't remember what the situation was exactly, but I was walking through the woods or down a road in the woods with one of these guys, and we came across an area, and there were a ton of deer tracks, and they were very obvious. And I immediately, you know, man, look at all these tracks, man. There's deer tracks everywhere. This is the place to be. And the man said, "You know what a deer track is?" I'm like, "Well, obviously I know what a deer track is." He said, "A deer track is where a deer used to be. So if you want to use deer tracks as your scouting tool, your way to, this is not exactly how he put it, but, you know, if you want to use tracks, they're just one piece of the puzzle. You've got to figure out where that deer came from, where he was going, why he left this track here, because this track just signifies that he used to be here. You don't know when he was here, why he was here, if he'll ever pass back through here. So maybe this is the spot to be. Maybe you get in a tree right over there and deer pass by this same trail and you get what you're looking for, or maybe they don't. So I think that, you know, I don't think that there is, to this question, I don't think that there's one answer of how do you scout land in Louisiana. You know, the person that sent this question did notate there's not the obvious pinch points and funnels, and that's true. But I think that one thing that is very important to people hunting in Louisiana or in the South in general is you, in the same way that while it might be easier, you learn when you hunt in the Midwest, you learn and you figure out what is a pinch point, what's a funnel, and it's easier to do, but their terrain is more, it's more uniform. It kind of stays the same. You go from crop field to hedgerow to crop field to creek bottom to crop field, and it's kind of the same. So you can go along those and see similar terrain to offer you a similar idea of how they're using each one, probably in much the same way. The first thing to do in the South is you have to understand that I might be hunting in a piece of property that's big hardwoods and, you know, very little diversity in that way, maybe some thicker areas, but generally big hardwoods with hills and hollows and ridge tops and all that. And I might get in my truck and drive 15 minutes down the road to go hunting with Colin, and I might be hunting on a 300-acre pine thicket that's completely flat and nothing but plantation pines. And then I might get in my truck and drive 15 minutes down the road to go hunt with Mr. Benny, and he's hunting in a swamp, you know, that borders some of the... And so we have vastly different terrain, and there is not one way that you scout all of them the same to figure them out. The deer are going to act differently in one of those versus the other. And my point in bringing up the track thing is, you know, you're hunting an area because you know most of the time, I would say, if not 100%, 99% of the time, you're hunting an area because you know there are deer there. You might not know how many or exactly, you know, what deer are there, but I hope that most of you aren't spending too much time hunting in a place where you don't even know if the deer even lives there. So you know that there's deer there. So when you walk in and you find a trail with tracks on it, all that's doing is confirming what you knew before you ever showed up. Old Monterey Outfitters. Come experience Midwest hunting at its finest. Whether it's a trophy whitetail, a pile of dry field ducks, geese, sandhill cranes, or a Rio Grande gobbler you're after, we're here to make it happen. Providing excellent lodging and meal experience for all of our clients, we run only one group of hunters at a time to make sure that group has the best hunting option and best experience to get the most out of their trip. We provide a family-friendly atmosphere with experienced, knowledgeable guides that put in the work day in and day out. Come find out what we're all about here in southern Kansas and northern Oklahoma. To get more information, visit oldmontereyoutfitters.com or contact Brett Harris at 903-720-3865. That's 903-720-3865. Killing a day at Old Monterey. You know, the best way to scout is to figure out how, you know, what is specific about this kind of terrain, because your buddy may be telling you to do this and do that, and where he's hunting is completely different because of our state's diversity.
Yeah, so, you know, down in the South, it's mostly woods, you know, whereas in the Midwest, you got pasture, ag, and different things like that. So, you know, you have to, when you scout, you have to find, there's going to be a large chunk of the woods that they're just not using. And you just have to find that there'll be something a little bit different, whether it's thicker or it's got more food or whatever. And you just find that section of the woods, however large it may be. And then, you know, I try to hone in on that section of the woods. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah. Well, so yeah. This is a good time for us to kind of segue into, I guess, what we would call our primary topic for the episode. We want to find out more about Buzzard Roost and the company that you've created, Mr. Benny. So, you know, it's a good segue because I think what I heard you say in your answer at first to this was that you do a lot of observation scouting, and I don't know that there's been too many things in our industry that have complemented observation style of scouting during the season much better than being super mobile, and the saddle is about the most mobile way that you can hunt these days, at least most effectively, it could be argued. So let's just start out by having you kind of tell us the story of where you came from and how you got to where you are today with Buzzard Roost.
Okay. So, yeah, I want to point out that is, like you're talking about the observation style scouting, that's what drew me to saddle hunting in general. And it was more of a mental game than a physical game, because I was still walking, you know, 3 miles to some of my spots on public land. And so I was doing it with a climber on my back, and I was able to do it, and I'm still physically able to do it. But it just, something about it didn't feel practical. It didn't feel comfortable to have this big stand on your back, walking through the woods, clanging against branches and things like that. So my next move was I bought a Muddy Bloodsport lock-on stand, and I bought it because it fit inside my body frame. And, you know, it stopped some of that clanking. It was more comfortable to carry. And while I was, you know, into that mobile hunting style there, I stumbled across saddles, and I was just like, well, cool. I want to try that. And so I got to looking for a saddle. And at the time, there was only one saddle on the market, and that was an Arrow Hunter Kestrel. And I got to looking at the price and everything of it, and, you know, I'm no different than anybody else today. You know, you look at a $400 price tag, and it's like, man, I don't even know if that's going to be comfortable. I don't know if that's what I want to do. You know, stands have been around for years, so, you know, a guy will look at a stand and say, yep, it's worth $400, and just spend it, and it'll show up at his doorstep. Well, when you're talking about saddles, you know, that's not what everybody wants to do. It's not what I wanted to do. So I went the cheap route, and there's a thing called a sit drag, and it's made for sitting at ground level, and it's about a 6 to 8 inch piece of webbing that just creates like a swing seat, and you attach it to the tree much like a saddle. If you've done any research on saddles, but at ground level. And so I looked into it, and I got my mom's sewing machine out, and I ended up splitting that sit drag in half long ways, and I sewed it back to itself, and I knitted some paracord in the middle, which created a seat, like a much like a old man tree stand or a Hasmore style seat. And that's what I started saddle hunting out of about 7-8 years ago. I started saddle hunting, and you know, that's where I got my roots in it. And I did a lot of mobile hunting and scouting, you know, with that sit drag, and it was able to get me places that, you know, I probably would have stopped a lot earlier, but it gave me the confidence to continue walking, and, you know, maybe 3 miles turned into 5 miles in total and hunting the hot sign versus, you know, just stopping at a spot and saying, oh, well, this looks good enough. I'll just stop here.
Yeah. What was there a moment or maybe not a specific moment, but a specific time frame in all of your research and development where you, like, is there a story to be told where you were like, yeah, I've got it. This is what I've been trying to put together.
I didn't really try to put together a saddle to bring to market. I didn't just one day say, you know, I'm going to make a saddle and it's going to go on the market and guys are going to love it and I'm not going to stop until I do. You know, I didn't do that. So saddle hunting was kind of growing. I did it, I think, for 2-3 years and I had buddies that were like, man, there ain't no way I'm doing that. And it kind of picked up and people were gaining interest, but still again there, they didn't want to go spend, you know, that kind of money and not know if they like it. So they was able to come to me and they asked and they said, hey, will you make me one? And so I did some research, got some pricing on materials and everything. And, you know, I was able to get materials, you know, for right around $100 or a little more, a little less, depending on what the guys wanted. And I'm just talking about my close friends here. I'm not talking about just acquaintances. And, you know, that's what got me started making them for guys. And I made a saddle for a buddy. And while I was making it, I had an aha moment, I guess you would say, that I was like, man, I wonder if I tried making this loop around a real short loop, unlike the other saddles that are a longer loop, and, you know, adjusting this will cause this to move without even trying. I don't want this to move. I want it to stay there, but I want this down here at the bottom to move off of my hip. And so while I was making it for him, I come up with that design, and it was probably about 11 to midnight that I was doing this, because I worked shift work in the plant, so I was messing around at midnight before my night shift the next night. And I went out on the porch, and when I sat in it, it was like, oh, man, this is nice. This is real nice. And so I brought it to him. Well, first, I put out my patent. I applied for a patent pending status, and, you know, I got that going. You know, there's a lot of patent rules around that that you can't just show everybody. You have to have applied first. So I did that, and then I brought it to him. I said, hey, I want you to try this and tell me what you think. And he did. And at that time, you know, there was other saddles on the market. There was Latitude and Cruiser and Tethered and Trophy Line. And he said, Benny, I got to tell you that, you know, I have two other saddles. And he said, this one right here ranks right up there with them. And he said, I got two others that are on the market, two different companies. And he said, this saddle ranks right up there with them. You have to try and do something with this. And I was like, man, don't lie to me. But he said, I'm not lying. You really got to try. And so I made a few more, and just for the same group of guys that were, you know, getting me to make other ones for them. And they all said the same thing, you know, this is really worth trying to go after. And so I did my LLC, and I had guys that started to get out of my friend group. And that's the moment where I said, okay, I got to go have this thing tested. I got to do everything 100%. And I did, and then I brought it to market, and it just started picking up after that, and guys were just saying how comfortable it was, and they really liked the name. That kind of draws them, Buzzer Grease, that, you know, that, mm-hmm. that name's kind of catchy. And other than that, Bubba, I don't know what other story to tell you.
No,
but that's how it came about.
No, that
it was just a It just evolved. It was never, I never meant to come to market with anything. It just, I got lucky, I guess, or blessed that it happened to me.
Well, it's a cool success story, and it's authentic, you know. It's authentic in its origins. Not to say that someone who sets out to create something to bring to market's inauthentic. It's not so much that. But something that has a very specific function when it's born from a passion project and not from a profit project. Something about it feels more organic. That's really cool. But I wanted to ask, this is not necessarily the time of the podcast that I thought I'd be asking this question, but one of the things I wanted to ask is about the name. Where it is a catchy name, and you got a cool logo, and I'm in digital marketing. That's what I do for a living. So I always, you know, branding is always catches my eye. So I'm curious how you came up with the name, because it is a good one.
Well, we have an area right here around Sanibel where I'm from. It's called Duck Roost. And so it was like, well, I can't use Duck Roost because there's another guy that has a restaurant named Duck Roost. And, you know, I told you I'm not a horn hunter. I'll shoot small bucks and things. I just don't have the time to really get into specific buck hunting. So I consider myself picking up the scraps sometimes. And the other guys that I hunt with, they're very similar to me, and we hunt public land. And excuse me. And I think that it comes from being more of a scrappy style hunter, and you know that's what buzzards do. They pick up the scraps. And so a buzzard perched into a tree, you know, he's on the roost, and I just put it together. It's a buzzard roost. We're here to kill animals and stand over a carcass at the end of the day.
That's really cool.
And, you know, that's what a buzzard does. They don't necessarily kill them, but they stand over the carcass at the end of the day. Well, so
that's awesome. I mean, it's cool to me that you have such an interesting and detailed backstory behind it, because it is a really cool name. That's a cool story.
Yeah, so
it wasn't as easy to come up with as you think.
Oh, I've been involved in branding for too long. I know. I know exactly. Sometimes,
hardest part of it.
Sometimes that is.
I don't care, easier than the name.
Yeah. What were you going to ask, Colin?
One of my questions was, so why the two-panel saddle? Is it comfort? Have you tinkered with a single panel, or what's the story behind that?
Yeah, so that is where I did. I'm not a business-minded guy at all. But one thing I do know about saddles, and I've watched them since the beginning, is that the number one question a guy will ask is it comfortable? So if I was going to do this, if I was going to shoot a shot, putting a saddle on the market, I knew it had to be a two-panel, because a two-panel, in general, from what I've looked into, is the more comfortable saddle. And my original saddle was a one-panel, and I tend to gravitate towards a one-panel, just being honest. Business-wise, it just made more sense to go with a two-panel because it is more comfortable. And the original design of my saddle that I have on the market was just the bottom panel. When I tell you, I went and I sat on the porch and sat in the saddle, and I was like, man, this is comfortable. It was just the bottom. It wasn't my top panel. And, you know, that's one thing that sets me apart from everybody else on the market, is I can take each of my panels and I can hold them in a different hand. I can hold the bottom of my left hand, I can hold the top of my right hand, and they're not connected, you know, until I connect them and complete the saddle. And that's different than everybody else. I can make adjustments on my bottom panel without adjusting my top panel, and vice versa. I can adjust the top panel without adjusting the bottom. And, you know, that is the key to my comfort in my saddle. And, you know, to get back on track with your question, you know, comfort's the number one question, and a two panel answers that question easier than a one panel does.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's so I'll admit I'm very new to saddle hunting. I got a saddle in January of last year, and I've said this on the podcast a couple times, so I'm not going to reiterate that whole story. But I mean, I hunted out of it a handful of times. I'm certainly not, you know, all the way comfortable with just everything that I need to be. I need to put in a lot more practice for this coming season and continue to work on that. But I've hunted in them and I've worn them enough now that I can see the, you know, the stuff that you're talking about. And you kind of answered one of my upcoming questions with that answer, in that I was going to ask you what sets your saddle apart from other ones on the market. But yeah, you kind of answered that with how you explained the two piece. So that's cool. I want to know, kind of going more into the personal side of it, you know, for you, how long did it take you to actually kill, when you did this, when you first started putting together a saddle for yourself and exploring that hunting style and all, how long did it take you to be successful and actually kill a deer out of your, one of your prototypes, we'll call it that for lack of a better word?
So out of my original saddle, I think I killed one on my first hunt. And when I say hunt, I take like 3-4 days and I'll go off and I'll go hunt. Mm-hmm. And I think I killed one on that first set. But maybe not, I don't think it was the very first fit in it, but it was the first set that I went.
Yeah. That's a pretty good proof of concept, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it had anything to do with you know, the saddle, because I don't believe a saddle is going to make you, all right, let me be careful how I say this. I don't think a saddle is going to make you kill more deer. I think that comes with woodsmanship, and I think you're going to be in deer whether or not you're in a saddle or packing a stand. I think that a saddle will lighten your load, and like I said before, it'll give you the confidence to maybe walk 5 miles and find the hot sign versus stopping at 3, or you know, just stopping somewhere because you're tired, it's hot, you know, all those factors that play in mentally that says, I'm just going to stop right here. You know, I think it eliminated a lot of those for me. So, I'm not going to say that a saddle will make you kill more deer, because just buying a saddle is not going to guarantee you a big buck or anything like that. But I think it's a great tool in your arsenal, no matter if you're a public land hunter, private land hunter, or what, because, you know, I think it's the most versatile tool out there. But if you've been hunting out of lock-ons forever and you're killing deer, I'm going to tell you, you don't need to swap. You don't need to get one. But yeah, if you did and you find yourself gravitating towards a saddle more, then that's what you should be in. It fits your style.
Yeah. So I film a lot of hunts, self-film some and film other people. And I made the switch to a saddle probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I mean, I love them. I think, you know, one of the biggest things for me is that, well, first off, filming, I don't have to have like the perfect shot, you know, with a bow. I just have to get a camera up there. But the main thing is that, you know, if I'm already hauling a 30-pound, you know, bag full of camera equipment, batteries, this, that, and the third, and I just throwing the saddle on is too easy and versus throwing, adding another, you know, 12 or 13 or 15 pound stand on the back of my backpack that's already heavy. So that's really the way that I utilize it the most, you know, coming being a cameraman.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
I'll argue that a guy that films his hunt or a cameraman, I will say he needs a saddle. Yep. Because I just think the weight reduction there is hands down the most beneficial to a cameraman.
Well, I can tell you from firsthand experience, for years I spent I don't know how much time hauling two stands into the woods or being limited in where we were hunting and filming because I had to have a double set that we could get two people in the tree and all that. And for the last 2 years, Colin has been filming hunts with me out of his saddle, and it has completely, I don't want to say it's changed anything, but it's completely, I say changed anything in the way we hunt, but it has definitely opened up opportunities to get into places and do things in what at least feels like a much more efficient manner. And when you're filming, usually you're on a time crunch as well. You're somewhere filming for so many days, and you know, like you said, you need to be able to go as far as you need to be able to go to be in the right spot and not just any spot. And you definitely offers that, and plus there's just the flexibility in a tree. I got one more question for you, Benny, because maybe this is self-serving for me a little bit, but after that we got a couple questions that we're gonna cover that were sent in to us when we posted about a saddle hunting conversation on the podcast, and had some people ask some questions that we'll run through before we wrap up. But one last question that I want to know, because this is what I'm struggling with as a new saddle hunter. How long did it take you, or maybe not how long did it take you, but what different methods did you do personally in your journey to get proficient with the shooting aspect of it? Because that's the part that concerns me the most. And I know practice is the ultimate answer, but, you know, just the mobility and the flexibility and the power that you have in being as mobile as you can be with a saddle is, in my mind, unquestioned. The questions that I do still have are, you know, the shooting out of the saddle and how challenging and different that can be. So how did you attack that?
To be honest, I just I went head first with it. I practiced just climbing and sitting in the saddle, but I didn't shoot out of the saddle until I went hunting. And I don't know why I did that. It was probably more of a time crunch thing than just a principle of I need to just go shoot a deer out of it first time I ever shoot out of a saddle. But for me, I was never nervous about sitting in the saddle. That just didn't bother me at all. And I know it does bother some people. And the advice I have for those guys is, you know, you need to do something to take your mind off of being in the saddle during your practice, to where you're not in the saddle anymore. You're just there as a part of a tree. And that sounds like really weird saying it, but just don't worry about being in the saddle and just take the shot. You have to be, I tell guys, get a buddy out there and just talk with them. Just hold a conversation while you're moving around the tree shooting and y'all are practicing. Let the buddy go retrieve arrows. You know, somebody that you can really hold a conversation with. You know, not somebody that's just going to stand there and be quiet in your backswing at, you know, while you're playing golf. You need to talk the whole time and take your mind off of the saddle and just shoot.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't be a thought you know, moving around the tree in the saddle. It shouldn't be a thought. You should just be shooting like you're standing on the ground. And I find it easier to shoot in a saddle than I do the in a chair scenario, like a ground blind. I find it much easier to shoot a saddle than that.
It's good advice. Not something I have not. That's a piece of advice that makes a lot of sense that I don't know that I've heard in this kind of conversation before. But yeah, you're probably right in my case in that it's a mental game of maneuvering around the whole situation, and I'm thinking about that and less about just, you know, because I know if I'm standing on the ground, I can contort my body and shoot in different angles. Why couldn't I do it standing on my platform, you know? And so that's a pretty good way to look at it. So I like that. So I mentioned before that we're gonna cover a couple questions. So I'm gonna kind of introduce these, get you to kind of give your thoughts about how you might would answer them, Benny, and then Colin and I, we might have an opinion. We generally do. About some things,
okay. But
so the first one is doesn't apply to me, applies a little bit more to Colin, but I have heard it and read it in different places. What are your opinions or thoughts about saddle hunting for bigger guys?
So bigger guys, I don't know that they're limited by anything by being in the saddle. Other than, you know, the 300-pound rating that the saddle has, you know, if they're above 300, I just can't, as a manufacturer, suggest that they get one that's, you know, rated at 300. And I don't know of one. There may be one, a saddle out there that is rated over 300. There might be one, like I said, but I don't know of it. And if it's out there, I say get in it. Try it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, just industry standard is 300 pounds.
Well, that's
but
kind of the case.
Bigger guys, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's kind of the case with lock-ons, too. I mean, lock-on stands, really.
Most of those 300?
Yeah, around that. And so are climbers. I mean, pretty much any I guess my thought about it, Benny, is I don't think bigger guys should feel more limited in saddles than they do in any mobile hunting. I mean, any small mobile lock-on or climbing stand, they all have the same kind of safety ratings. And, you know, as long as you're buying a saddle that fits you the correct way and you're within the recommended specifications on the weight rating and all, I guess at that point it just comes up to, you know, your own physical capability. So the question kind of reads, what's the best saddle option for bigger guys? And I think the best saddle option is whatever fits you best as long as you fit within the safety regulations. That's a fair way to put it?
Yeah, definitely. I'll say this. If the guy's listening, that Latitude makes an XL version. And, you know, I've got a lot of feedback that Latitude XL 2-panel is very comfortable.
Something to check out.
And then also, yeah, as long as you don't exceed the 300 pounds, you know, you're welcome to call me and I can build you a saddle, you know, for a bigger guy. Now, my standard large saddle, it stops at about a 44, you know, but that's just because I don't really have a market bigger than that, but I can make you a one-off saddle that will go, you know, if you're a short 300-pound guy and you got a little bit bigger waist, you know, email me. I'll make you a saddle.
Yeah, I kind of think that if you're a bigger guy, the saddle may be a better option because if you get one that fits you right, I would imagine it's going to be more comfortable than some of them small, lightweight mobile stands they have now where the seat's like 10 inches wide. That's not going to be comfortable for much more than maybe 2 hours. The platforms are really small, and you're just kind of limited. But as long as you meet the safety standard and it fits you, just because you're bigger doesn't mean it's going to be any less comfortable, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Right. It's not. As long as it fits you correctly, like you said, one thing that, you know, I'll have to pay attention to if a guy was to call me is I'd have to get him a longer bridge. And because the longer your bridge is, the more room you have for the geometry to work and not give you hip pinch. And I make a really good saddle that doesn't give you hip pinch, but even I can't beat physics, you know.
Right.
If you're a bigger guy and I put a short bridge on your saddle, it's going to pinch you. It's going to pinch you. So angles are something to pay attention to for bigger guys. You know, if they put it too high, it tends to pull up on them, and that creates some discomfort, and it also gives that pinch. So I would say a bigger guy would probably have to run his tether a little bit shorter, I mean lower, and then a longer bridge.
So let's talk about this next question. And this kind of plays into my personal, when I ask you the question about shooting and getting, you know, comfortable with that, getting into saddle hunting, this one, this kind of plays into that. The question reads, do you have any tips for shot setups? I feel like it takes a lot more movement to change shot directions than it would in a lock-on. And I can say that personally, I found myself in the limited amount of time that I hunted out of a saddle last season, I did feel more limited in that regard, not because I didn't think it was possible, but because I knew that I had not practiced it and I wasn't comfortable trying to do it in a hunting scenario. So I found myself limiting how I set up so that really I was only able to shoot in limited spots from my setup, which would have been on my strong side where I knew I felt comfortable getting drawn back and anchored correctly and all that. So I guess the best way to answer the question would be any tips for learning how to set up those shots outside of your obvious strong side shot?
Yeah. So what you need to do is, like I talked about before, is you need to have somebody out there talking with you, and y'all just practice shooting and have that guy, have your wife or something moving the target around. And instead of, I don't want you to focus on what you're doing. I just want you to do it and move your feet around. And, you should have already taken inventory of what's around your feet ahead of time. If there's a limb, a branch or a leaf or something that could make noise, or if the bark is rough, take inventory of that when you're in your hunting situation. But learn to move around that tree without even thinking about it or having to put specific focus on, you know, where you're going to land your feet. You need to know where your feet are going without having to look down. And that will create a fluid motion so that you can move silently and left. I don't know. I think about it like watching Jurassic Park. They tell you the T-Rex is attracted to motion. Yeah. So you want it to be fluid and calm in your movement so that you don't attract attention to yourself. But I think if you let the deer get close enough in a hunting situation that you're going to be above their peripherals and you can move all you want. That's my goal, is to let them get so close underneath me that I don't have to worry about them seeing me from far out. I don't take my bow off the hook until they're in killing distance. Unless they're running in. Obviously, you have to, you know, be quicker. But when they're running in, they're not exactly looking up at the tree at you anyway.
Yeah.
So you just reach and grab your bow and make the movement and shoot. But if they're just walking into a feed tree, I say let them get in underneath you before you even grab your bow.
Yeah, another tip, too, is So if you think about it like a clock, and if you set your climbing sticks coming up the tree to like your 9 or 10 o'clock, and if you put them even with your platform, you can work your foot around and actually come off your platform and onto the top of your climbing stick and work around that tree to make like that. And you can actually work far enough around where you can make like that 2 or 3 o'clock, which would typically be your weak side. You can make that 2 or 3 o'clock shot very easily just by having your stick level with the top of your stick level with your platform. That's another thing to keep in mind too.
You know,
yeah, that's excellent. The top of your stick's not great for standing on, but it will be a great maneuvering tool to take shots like what you talked about. Yeah, good tip.
I think it you know, it sounds to me, I don't have the experience that either two of you have in doing this, but, and I've always been a lock-on hunter, you know, since I was old enough to do that, and because I always wanted to be a little more mobile, either climbing. I kind of climbing stand a lot too when I was younger. And, you know, at some point in everybody's life or journey as a hunter, you know, the first time you put 20 or 25 foot of sticks however high you want to go, and you stand on a small, lightweight, mobile lock-on platform, you have to do a lot of the same things that you're talking about when it pertains to just being comfortable and being able to turn either way and do it fluidly without having to put your hand down and brace yourself and look down at your feet. I mean, that, you know, I guess some people are blessed. I'm not, I don't have a fear of heights, but I don't think you have to have a fear of heights to just be aware. You know, I mean, a fear is a natural emotion that keeps us safe. And when you're standing on a small platform, not much bigger than your boots, and you're trying to, you know, make a major turn, that comes with experience. Being able to do that fluidly while keeping your eye on the animal to make sure that you're moving at the right times and getting everything in position without having to stop and grab the tree and look down at your feet and all the things you talked about practicing to make sure that you can move around in your saddle setup almost, you know, just fluidly without even looking or even thinking about it. You all of us have at some point have evolved that ability standing on a lock-on platform as well. And so this doesn't really, it doesn't seem like it would be all that much different. You just got to do it. You know, I mean, to your point, I guess I'm just reiterating what you said. You got to do it in order to get where you can, you know, the question is any tips for shot setup? Well, you know, first of all, I think that, you know, the way you set up on the tree has a lot to do with the area you're hunting and where you expect the deer to come and go from and all that. But all the shot setup stuff is got to be done before. You know, if you want to be able to set yourself up to take advantage of whatever that deer might do when he gets in bow range, you've got to be able to move around as comfortably and effortlessly while maintaining your ability to keep your eye on the animal and move at the right time and all that kind of stuff. That I don't think that's really that much different than how you learn to hunt with whatever you're hunting with right now. It's just an experience thing. So,
yep.
Yeah. So, when it comes to picking your shot placement, when I'm setting up on the deer, obviously in a saddle, like that's one of the main, benefits to a saddle is, there should not be a spot where you can't shoot the deer. And that holds true, I'd say 99% of the time. You want to be able to deal with the unexpected. But for me, when I set up, I expect the deer to come out at, say, my, we'll call it 7-8 o'clock position. So when I'm sitting in the tree, I'm looking for them to come at my 7-8 o'clock. And walk into my 9 o'clock, and from my 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock is a quarter and away shot. So when I say that deer is, you know, I'm not in their peripherals anymore when they're in the kill zone, you know, I'm right-handed, so I'm grabbing my bow with my left hand, and I almost don't even have to move at all on my platform to take that kill shot because I let them come in from my back. And now if they take and they go more towards my six, then I'll grab the bow and I'll take a 6 o'clock drop shot.
Mm-hmm.
But that is my preparation for a deer.
Another thing, this parallels, and it's going to segue into our last question really well. We've had a lot of conversations I've had with friends and whatnot hunting, but we've had them on this podcast too, just talking about setting up and hunting to where you're getting set up the right way. And I think one of the biggest mistakes as a bow hunter that people make, and I have watched it unfold in front of me way more times than I care to recall, is people go out and they hang their stand, they set up their lock on their ladder stand in an area, whether it's a edge of a food plot or wherever for whatever reason. And in doing so, they get the stand set up, and then they back up and they spend 45 minutes with a pole saw making sure that any deer that gets within bow range of that stand, they can kill it. They're like, well, what if the deer comes over there? What if the deer comes over here? And what they end up doing, in my opinion, is they hurt themselves because they've taken away, in too many cases, they've taken away a lot of what made that the right tree to put the stand on to begin with. By cutting down a lot of your cover and all that. And what I'm getting all the way around to with that is, as a bow hunter, we're not rifle hunters. And you've got to learn to set your spot up, whatever you're hunting in. However, whether it's an existing spot you set up or a mobile spot, you got to get in there with a really strong idea of how you're going to kill a deer out of this spot, and accept the fact that if he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, you may not get the shot. But if you try to pick, if you're standing there and you're looking at a tree, and you know good and well that that's the right tree, if I get on this tree facing this direction, there's a very high probability that if I've got this figured out right, the deer are going to do this, and that puts me in the right situation. If you change your mind and get in this other tree because, well, but what if I go get in this tree, yeah, I'm not really exactly in the right spot, and yeah, I don't have as much cover, but if the deer happens to do this, I'll be able to take the first shot, and I'll also be able to take these other shots. I think that's overthinking it. I think it's not only overthinking it, but it's getting yourself into a place mentally where you make a bad decision, because you probably should have relied on your woodsmanship and your instincts as a hunter to know that, hey, this is the right spot. I knew it was the right spot when I walked in here, and now I'm backing up, getting in this spot where I think I'm covering more ground, but I'm not on the X anymore. That's kind of my take on that. But all right, let's jump into the last question. I saved this one for last because you've already kind of commented on it, but I really liked your answers and the way you talked about this. So I'm just going to get you, as we're wrapping up here, to just kind of comment a little bit more on this question and see if there's any more to add to what you've already said. The question is, is a saddle worth it on private land? Fixed sets on private versus saddles on private. You talked about this a little bit in your identifying the saddle as a tool and all that kind of stuff, but just comment on that one last time here, and we'll wrap up after this.
Okay. Yeah, I think it is worth it for every hunter to have, unless you are a strict box stand hunter, or you are a guy that has one of those properties that you have deer coming on camera and you're consistently killing deer every year that you're putting on your wall, and they're just coming in front of your lock-on stand. I think if you're doing that consistently, you don't have a reason to swap over to a saddle. Now, I do think that guy that's consistently killing bucks from his lock-on stand, he might could kill him a day or two earlier because he's on the other side of the food plot. He's still coming to the food plot every day. But say you got a 4-day set to go hunting, and you know, you see him 2 evenings in a row on the far side of the food plot, you know, it's just my opinion that the third day is probably going to do the same thing. There's something there drawing him. And I would hope that my woodsmanship will tell me and I'd know what it is that's drawing him over there in the first place. But if he's over there 2 days in a row, the third day, I'd have a saddle in a tree where I could kill him. And I think that's where a saddle shines, is its ability to be moved easier than a stand can. And I 100% believe in the first time that you sit a tree is your best opportunity to kill a deer, whether it be a big buck, be a doe, or just whatever walks by. I think that's your best opportunity. And I think the one thing about a saddle versus a tree stand is you cannot be told no, that you can't climb that tree with a saddle. You can't do it.
Yeah.
You can in a lock-on or a climber, especially a climber. A lock-on gives you a little more freedom. Well, a saddle, I think, just takes that completely out of the game. And so that, for me, is why I hunt mostly out of a saddle. Now, I'm not going to say if a buddy says, hey, I got a lock-on right here, and the deer are passing, you know, I'll probably just go sit his lock on, because I mean, deer die out of lock ons every year, and they have been for years. So, for me to discount that lock on's in the right spot. But a saddle, you know, and like what I said, if the deer's coming across the food plot and he does it consistently, you need that ability to be able to move on him and kill him.
Yeah, I'll wrap up by saying that I think that the majority of guys who might be listening to this who fit into that category of having, you know, private land that they've done their work and they've set it up and they have a lot of really good sets and they hunt them successfully year after year after year, I think the majority of those guys can still think of a number of situations where they've thought, man, I'd really like to be able to go hunt that area, but I, you know, there's not a tree I can climb, and I don't really want to go get a stand up in there. And if they had the saddle, they could slip in there and make at least just make an observation sit and see. You know, I think all of
exactly.
I think all of us as hunters are curious by nature, and like you said, this is a tool. It's not an end-all, be-all. It's a tool in your arsenal of things to not only potentially help make you more successful, but just to help you enjoy what you're doing. I mean, you know, it's a pastime. It's a hobby. You know, hunting is something that we do to enjoy. And if being able to throw your saddle gear in the back of your side-by-side and just venture off into that hollow that you've never had a stand in before and make that hunt and see what's up in there, before you go treaching down through there trying to hang a stand, if that is fun to you, if that improves your decision making on how you're going to set up your private ground, then it's worth it, you know. Then to your point, then you got it there at the camp. If for some reason you do get on the biggest deer you've ever had on your property and you can't seem to get him in bow range, and you need to move 100 yards without blowing him out of the area or something like that, then you've got it. It becomes that tool, and that's what it's become for me over the years of just following the increased interest in saddles and all the conversation about people hunting out of saddles. I'll kind of wrap up by saying I think it's really cool, just as Louisiana bow hunter from Louisiana bow hunter, I think it's really cool that we have someone in our state making a quality product. We're proud to have you guys advertising here with us this season, and we love the idea that, you know, I think we all as in the South in general, but in this state, we're proud people, and we think that we're all good hunters, and there's a lot of really good hunters here. So having a company here local that's producing an innovative and quality product is really cool, and I'm glad we were able to have you on to talk more about it and more about the story and more about the company. So we really thank you for taking the time.
Yep.
Locke, I appreciate it, man. Yeah, that's very well said, and we really do appreciate those kind words.
Yeah. Colin, do you have anything else you want to mention before we wrap up?
Just, if you're on the fence about it, just go get you one. Try it out. You'll probably end up liking it, but if you don't, nowadays the resale value is very high, so you won't lose very much money.
Well, I can attest to that. I mean, Levi even posted a meme about me on the community page not long ago about me saying I was going to stick with my lock-ons, and I have to say that I've been more intrigued about it every day since I got one, and I think it's really cool. So as we wrap up here, Benny, tell everybody the best way that they can get in touch with you or order a saddle or whatnot. Just kind of give everybody those pertinent details.
Okay, man. So you can go on BuzzardRoofSaddles.com, and that's where you can purchase a saddle from us. You can purchase a saddle. You can purchase the lineman belts, the lineman and tether ropes. We are in the process of making some pouches, and we haven't come up with a design yet that we're ready to release. We want to do something a little different than, you know, what's out there on the market. So we don't want to just do what everybody else is doing. And one thing I do want to mention is that we offer an American flag patch that will add to your saddle for an extra $10. And Buzzard Roost does not make any money off of this patch that you add. What we do with it is every time we sell 20 saddles or 20 of those patches to add to saddles, we're going to donate a saddle to a service member, and that can be an active military or veteran, law enforcement officer, firefighter, EMT, a service member that serves our community. We want to take care of them and say thank you and donate a saddle. So if y'all can help us out and add that patch to your saddle when you make the order, we greatly appreciate that so that we can give back to those that give so much to us. So that's at BuzzardRoofSaddles.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. That is a good way to get in touch with us. We also answer emails, BuzzardRoofSaddles@yahoo.com, or just go on the BuzzardRoofSaddles.com click on the contact us link and you can get a hold of us. And we generally answer within the day. So, thank you, Locke. That's all I got about how you can get in touch with us.
Well, we appreciate you supporting Louisiana Bowhunter and advertising with us, and appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk with us on this episode. It's been a good conversation, and we wish you the best of luck this hunting season, not only with your hunting, but also with Buzzard Roost. Hope to see the company really grow. And for Colin and I, we are going to jump on an airplane here in a couple of days, and we are going to fly out to the mountains and do something we've never done before. So hopefully we all return in one piece with a bull elk in tow and a story to tell about that. We'll see. We're venturing off into uncharted territories for us. But we're going to go give it a shot, and hopefully there'll be a bunch of stories to tell about that. And in the meantime, we have just released several new products at LouisianaBowhunter.com, new merchandise products, some new hat designs and T-shirt designs. Really encourage you to go check those out at LouisianaBowhunter.com. And also, we're starting to get a lot of merchandise out into stores, both new stores and existing stores where you've seen our products in the past. So support your local retailers. And if you got a store, whether it be just a little corner store that a lot of hunters like to stop at to and from the woods, or a hardware store with an outdoor section, or a full-fledged archery shop or outdoor shop, if you got one that you think needs to have Louisiana Bowhunter merchandise in it, give us a shout, give us a heads up, and we'll reach out and see if we can't get that out there. And But if you don't do that, if you're not a retail guy, you can pick up anything we got. And we got some pretty cool stuff coming, and we got more cool stuff coming in October as well. Some archery gear as well as merchandise. So encourage people to do that and take part in the Louisiana Bowhunter community online. It's something that we promote often on the website. Often on the podcast. And we really want people to jump on there and talk. With the season coming, I know a lot of people have got a lot of cool pictures and videos of things that they're doing to get ready, trail cams, and all kind of stuff like that. That's what that community page is supposed to be about, is for the Louisiana bow hunter and all of us that are Louisiana bow hunter to really be a community and have that resource to bounce questions off each other and just enjoy the greatest time of the year, because it's right around the corner. And we'll be back, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. If you have anybody you'd like to hear on the show, reach out to us at info@louisianabowhunter.com. And if you want to help support Louisiana Bowhunter, go by your local archery shop and pick up some merchandise. If you don't have any at your local shop, let us know and we'll reach out to them. Or pick up your gear at louisianabowhunter.com and we'll ship it out to you same day. See you next week.